There already was natural variation in some that produced a large amount of hydrogen cyanide or prussic acid compared to some that produced low amounts. But we developed a hybrid that doesn't produce any Durin or HCN. We haven't been able to find any HCN production in this hybrid. And so basically, we used EMS mutagenesis to knock out the first enzyme in the Durin pathway. And so we just don't have any Durin in the plant.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. A robust return on your sorghum investment is not just a dream. Learn more at doubleteamsorghum.com. KWS Hybrid Rye, seeding the future since 1856.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor in Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Shelby Gruss. She is an Assistant Professor in Forage Extension at Iowa State University. Shelby, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's great to have you here with us today. And I want to start things off asking you if you can share with us your path to where you are today and your background as well.
Thank you for having me today. So a little bit about me. I just started at Iowa State last November, so I've only been here for about 10 months. And I kind of took a little bit of a different path getting here. Traditional in the sense that I did my bachelor's, my master's, and PhD, then a postdoc. But when I started, I never would have told you I'd have been a professor. I was like, I'm going to industry. That's my goal. And so I did my undergrad and my master's at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And I had a really big focus on plant breeding and genetics. I had a really big interest in being able to improve the hybrids and varieties we have out to help increase yields and just the better lives of many of our producers and farmers. So I finished up my master's there, and then I was kind of in this in-between zone if I just wanted to go straight to industry or get my PhD. And my mentor was like, Shelby, don't be stupid. You need to get your PhD. It's going to be your best opportunity, and you're just going to be able to do so many more things with it. And so I had the great opportunity of going to Purdue. And while I was there, I was working on Durin-free sorghum. And so if you don't know, sorghum produces a prussic acid, which is really dangerous to livestock. It can kill them. And so we basically were able to develop a hybrid that does not produce prussic acid. And during that time, I was kind of felt natural that this would work in a forage setting. What animals eat? How will they do with it? So we looked at quite a few different aspects of it in a forage setting. And during that time, I worked with Dr. Keith Johnson there. They're a forage extension specialist, and I absolutely fell in love with what he did. So about 2 years into my PhD, I said, you know what? I don't want to go to industry. I want to work in extension. And so I started following him around, and he taught me a lot. And then I had the great opportunity of going to Michigan State with Kim Cassida as a postdoc. And I worked in perennial forages while I was there. I had this amazing opportunity working on what's called the Resilience Cap Project. And it really focuses on diversity, perenniality, and circularity in our systems and trying to make them more resilient to weather anomalies, economic ups and downs, everything that kind of comes along with that. And so got that opportunity. And now here I'm at Iowa State, and I'm working kind of in both things that I was able to do during my PhD now and my postdoc at Michigan State, working a lot in summer annuals. When I first got here, we were in a 3-year drought. That drought has broken, so we've had some flooding, but some of my research has focused on summer annuals, looking at that Durin-free hybrid still and how we can expand grazing into the fall with it, diversifying with cover crops and double cropping systems and intercropping systems and some different things like that. So just trying to help diversify the landscape a little bit and seeing how that can help with resilience.
Perfect. That's fantastic. I do want to follow up on the Durin-free sorghum research you've done and how that's translating to your program now as well. So myself, not coming from a forage or animal background, you know what, I know a little bit of it, but you know, could you expand a little bit on that topic and just tell us some more about, you know, what is durin, what's the impact that has on animals that forage or feed is being fed to, and also what are some of the options that growers have to manage or avoid any issues from that?
Yeah, so durin is the precursor to basically causing hydrogen cyanide or prussic acid toxicity in animals. And so basically the plant, when it's really young or when it's really stressed after like a frost, it makes this, basically produces durin. And it's thought to be a protective, basically barrier to from grazing of insects, insects helping intolerance of that, and basically protecting itself. But when that comes to play is also when animals graze it. So prussic acid toxicity basically can happen very, very quickly. It leads to convulsions, spasms, and then death within minutes in severe cases. So it can seem really, really scary and really detrimental, but farmers have been managing this for years. And so basically there's probably like 5 or 6 different things we think about is to avoid grazing. So we avoid grazing really small plants. So plants that are shorter than 18 inches tall, those have really high durin accumulation, which could cause really high prussic acid potential. We avoid grazing plants after a frost event for at least a week. So a frost comes through and we basically remove our animals for a week. And that's a rolling suggestion. So if another frost occurs, we need to restart that week until we have a killing frost. After a killing frost, we can wait 7 days and then we can graze those plants fairly safely. The plant can't react anymore because the plant is dead. And then extreme drought situations, we want to avoid those as well. But that's not just for prussic acid, that's also for nitrate accumulation can cause injury to animals. And then if we are concerned about high durin accumulation or prussic acid potential, we have a few options. Ensiling is thought to decrease prussic acid potential by about 50 to 70%. So that can help making that product more safer for our animals. And so those are just some opportunities that we can use there. Cutting it for silage also basically helps dilute the feed because the prussic acid is higher in the leaves than in the stems. And when animals are grazing, they're going to choose to graze the leaves first and then the stems second. So it can help with that a little bit as well. And so those are some of the things farmers have already been doing. And there's a rare occasion that I've actually heard of prussic acid poisoning happening, but it is a fear concern that is that most farmers have. And it's one of the questions I always get if somebody starts to use sorghum or sorghum sedan grass. That's one of the first ones.
Perfect. And so those would be more from perhaps the management perspective, taking into consideration the size of the plants, these weather events as far as a frost or maybe drought, and then they can do ensiling to reduce that as well. So on your research, you were working also on the genetic side of that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So can you tell us also that genetic component of it? Like what is, you know, are there perhaps genetics coming down the pipeline that producers could be more, you know, or trust that that would not be an issue even under these circumstances that you listed already?
Yeah. So there already was natural variation in some that produced a large amount of hydrogen cyanide or prussic acid compared to some that produce low amounts. But we developed a hybrid that doesn't produce any durin or HGN. We haven't been able to find any HGN production in this hybrid. And so basically we used EMS mutagenesis to knock out the first enzyme in the durin pathway. And so we just don't have any durin in the plant. And so a lot of testing has been done in drought situations, frost situations, and just grazing situations in general, looking for hydrogen cyanide production in these plants. And we've been able to show that it's safe after a frost. It's safe it's safe from durin production after a drought. And we basically solve a very good product that does not have that concern anymore. So it just eliminate it helps with that safety factor.
Awesome. And so in these hybrids that would be durin free, are there any trade-offs there as far as, you know, how is their yield and also forage quality performance? How does that compare with the traditional hybrids or varieties that can produce durin?
That was one of the big things we tested, because that's a great question, because at the end of the day, if it doesn't yield well, we're seeing less quality, we're not going to get much acceptance on it. We actually did not see a decline in yield or quality in these hybrids. We tested it for preference grazing. Our animals actually preferred the durin-free. We hypothesized that this is because it has hydrogen cyanide has a bitter taste to it. So if there's high amounts of it, the animals can taste it. And so they're selecting something that has a little less bitter of a flavoring. But that's just a hypothesis on that. But we saw animals perform equivalently compared to hybrids that are on the market today. The only thing that we did see a little bit difference to was we did some insect to bravery studies, because the idea was, okay, this is a protectant from insect herbivory. We did see a little bit of a preference for insects to it, chewing insects specifically. I know there's a lot of concern out there for aphids on sorghum. I don't really see that being as much of a problem. We did not test it, but just the way aphids feed, they wouldn't disrupt the durin and the plants anyway, so there would be no HCN release. And so I would suspect it would be similar. We did not test that though. And so there is that little bit of a difference that we do have. We're going to need maybe an insecticide. But when we did it and we spread it and then we put fall armyworms on them, the plant was able to grow fairly well, even with the armyworms on there, and keep up in growth for the time frame we tested for.
Fantastic. So it seems like it could really be an important option that growers have when selecting their hybrid. Having something like this that really offers many benefits.
Yeah, I think it could be a really good opportunity. One thing I would like to add, we did look at this in a forage system. We didn't really look at it in the grain production side. And so there's some hypothesis that there might be a little bit of deficit in grain, but we did not look at that because we were really focused on that forage aspect.
So my next question for you is related to another connection coming from your previous experiences and that now you're translating into your program when you're talking about intercropping, right? And so I guess overall, could you tell us a little bit about your intercropping projects? What are you evaluating? And also what you already are seeing, or maybe what do you expect to see as far as trade-offs of that diversification, right? We know that a lot of things in nature, there's no best or worst, there are trade-offs, right? So what would be the trade-offs that you would see in a intercropping system when compared to less diversified systems?
Yeah, like you said, there's always trade-offs. I'll give you kind of a background of the intercropping I'm working on so I can specifically implement it to those. I think summer annuals are really interesting species in the sense that we can cut them multiple times. They're going to regrow in that year. And so a lot of times we're looking at intercropping or adding cover crops to a corn and soybean rotation, specifically here in Iowa. And we're not giving them a lot of an opportunity to establish well before we go into basically until winter. We just don't have a lot of time. We use full season crops, try to basically have something growing when it can be. But being able to cover that during the winter would be really beneficial. And so I know we've been working on interseeding earlier in the season, but when that corn canopy closes, there's not much that's growing. It kind of hangs out. It'll wait until we remove it and then start growing again. And so it just has that little bit of a shorter time frame to be able to establish well. And so what I want to do with these summer annuals, and that's what we started working on this year, is we can cut it the first time and we went directly right in behind that first cutting and we planted cover crops so that they can start growing back together. And then we'll cut it again the second time, opening that canopy again, giving that cover crop more time to be able to establish and hopefully produce more biomass. And the goal is to produce more biomass for fall grazing. And so that's where that Dern-free sorghum comes into play. It's a really great producer. But then if we have fall grazing, we're not concerned about the prussic acid and allowing them to grow together going into the fall to extend our grazing seasons here, really trying to give as much biomass and as long of grazing as we can. Additionally, we're doing this with alfalfa, trying to establish alfalfa in the canopy. And I know there's been some work with corn silage as well. And so we did a planting together with our summer annuals and alfalfa, hoping that double cutting system will help open the canopy, give it more sunlight, giving it a better opportunity to establish. And then we also did a fall planting. We followed that first cutting. We planted it in between the rows, and we're going to take another cutting again, opening that canopy, trying to give both of them an opportunity to thrive. And that kind of goes into that. What are your trade-offs? And so generally speaking, you're either trying to favor one or the other. I'd say intercropping or nurse crops are not new to alfalfa. A lot of people use oats and things, but we generally have to pick one or the other that we're focusing on, because if we do too much of one, we're going to hurt the other. And so in those aspects, like, we're planting the sorghum Sudan grass on 30-inch rows, trying to give a better opportunity for that alfalfa to thrive. But with that, we're kind of running into weed control problems is our biggest thing right now, because we have a grass growing with a legume, and there's not a lot of things we can spray right now to be able to control the weeds. And so weed control, but our fall stand looks great because we were able to row cultivate and kind of clean out the weeds before we planted the fall planting. And same with the cover crops. It's a very clean field right now comparatively to when we planted them together. And so that's one of the aspects that we're kind of seeing a little bit of a downfall right now for our spring planting. We do have a bit of a weedy patch there. But the alfalfa is there, and I'm hopeful for the spring because a lot of the weeds are definitely summer or annual weeds. And so hopefully the alfalfa will be able to outcompete coming in the spring. But that'll be something we find out.
Sounds great. Well, thanks. That was really interesting to hear about those trade-offs, because normally I think we like to think of the benefits a lot more than the downsides. And really listening to a trade-off analysis like what you just described is really interesting to really see that full picture. All right. So, you know, one very hot topic so I'm in Georgia, Southeast US, you know, it's hotter and more humid than the Midwest. And we're just seeing so many issues with fall armyworm, especially this year. And I know this is something that is an issue that you're also seeing in your region. So can you tell us a little bit about that specifically? Like what has been the impact, especially this year, on forages in Iowa and perhaps in the Midwest in general? And what are people doing to control it? You know, what's going to be the outcome of this fall armyworm season?
Yeah, so we just started seeing it probably a few weeks ago coming in the southern Iowa. Actually, one of our first big calls was a soybean field, which is not very often heard of. It was basically completely devoured by fall armyworms. And anybody that has had fall armyworms in the past know how destructive they can be. I've seen an alfalfa field where by morning to night, it just looked like a completely different field because they are super active. So we have basically been trying to be a little bit preventative this year, trying to keep farmers and producers out in their fields, watching what's going on, being aware that they're there and scouting. We basically have taken off our last hay cutting right about now. Depending if you're in northern Iowa, probably a week ago to a week and a half ago. So thankfully in that case, a lot of their food source isn't there right now. So they might kind of skip the field currently, but that regrowth to be able to protect it, being out there to make sure if we're starting to see we're hitting thresholds and being ready to spray if we need to protect that regrowth as we're going into winter can be really important. But really just trying to keep our producers on their toes, looking for what's going on. It's a really busy season right now, so it's really easy to be like, oh, I'm done with my alfalfa. I have to go do corn silage. I have to go harvest my corn, grain, soybeans, and things like that. Just trying to keep them aware that they're there. We need to keep an eye out and just going to your field, checking to see what's going on.
Yeah. And so for growers that may be worried about that and think that, you know, they need to intervene, what are some of the options that growers have to just try to keep the armyworms at bay and not destroy a field?
So typically when I talk to a producer, the first thing I say is, like, if you hear your neighbors have it and you're debating if you need to cut or not, I would just cut your field and remove that food source as soon as you can. But that's not an option because we're kind of in this 6-week time frame before hard frost. So we don't want to injure our alfalfa stands or our fields, our hay fields. Chemical control is a possibility with an insecticide. Pyrethroids, I believe, it has shown promise in controlling them. But we have to do it when they're young. They start to see some resistance as they get older. And I think it's about a half an inch. After a half an inch, we start to see less control of the fall armyworm. And also trying to do spraying when they're active. So morning and the evening when they're really active can help with the control as well.
Perfect. That's great. I don't farm, but I have a lawn and it has been under attack. It's bad. Yeah. My new hobby was to go out, you know, like after coming from work and just, you know, squeezing the fall armyworms that I would see around.
Just take your mower out there once or twice. See if, yeah.
Yeah. It's bad.
Yeah.
Awesome. So something else that, you know, perhaps, well, I guess I'm not sure how widespread of an issue this is, but definitely in the Midwest is a big issue, is hail damage, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that? You know, what's basically, I guess, you know, if you could start off just telling us or explaining to us, what is the frequency of these events, especially in the Midwest, and how do growers cope with it, or what can they do about it? Something hard because it's weather related. There's not much you can do before it, but how are they managing after it, I guess?
Yeah, hail's one of those ones that we probably get every year, but not in the same place every year. They can be really small pockets that are just very devastating depending on where they're hitting and where it's happening. I think we had 3 or 4 different hail events here in Iowa that were pretty large spread, considering we had some in southern to central and I think a little bit in western Iowa this year. And we've kind of had a pretty bad storm systems all around this year in Iowa, between tornadoes, hail, and just complete downpours. But a lot of times hail damage, unfortunately, it's kind of a crop insurance fallback, especially in your corn and soybeans. Alfalfa is really great at being able to regrow. Basically, it hails. You need to be going out there, and it can help determine based on the height of your plant how many terminal buds are injured. So that's your growing points at the top of the plant if they're broken off, and also the age of your stand. If it's a really young stand that was just seeded and we don't really have a crown yet, and those growing points are broken off, the stand unfortunately is going to probably lead to a stand failure because there's no place for that plant to grow back from. But if it's an older stand and we have a lot of hail damage on it, maybe the thing that we need to do is just we'll let it regrow depending on height, growing point damage, and just the damage in general. But sometimes we don't have that much damage. We're only like 10% of our growing points are damaged. Allowing it to grow to a normal cutting stand could be beneficial as well. So it really depends on the level of damage that you're seeing, because some hail events, you won't see as much damage as others.
Oh, that sounds great. And so really, it's a really interesting issue, you know. So we're talking about hail damage and fall armyworm. So abiotic stress is here. And I want to follow that thread up with, based on your experience in the Midwest and what you're expecting to also encounter in your program and working with growers in Iowa, besides these issues of hail and armyworm specifically, what are some of the other challenges that forage producers in Iowa are facing, and how do you, you know, how do you envision being able to help them with those?
Yeah, I think Iowa forage producers in a lot of the Midwest, our weather is just becoming more and more unknown of what we're going to get. And so I've been trying to think about different ways that we can diversify a small amount of our acreage to ensure we have forage, so that if there's some type of stand loss, like maybe there's something else that's growing. So I think diversity is a really great player in that aspect, being able to produce forage at a different time with cover crops, how we utilize that. Iowa producers also, I think most producers have this problem as well. Land constraints. It's not easy to get more land. And so we have to be able to maximize more on the acreage we have. And in Iowa, a lot of times our forage land is our second best land. If it can go to corn and soybeans, a lot of times it does. And so being able to maximize forage is really important throughout the year. And so a lot of times we're talking about double cropping systems. If you take corn silage, can we plant a winter cereal to get a crop that next spring before we go back into something else? Diversifying our rotations, adding those cover crops, or maybe adding a summer annual into, instead of planting 100 acres of corn silage, let's plant 80 of corn silage and 20 of the summer annual. Something different that could potentially maybe do better in a drought if we have the drought. Or one thing that I'm looking at is tar spot. If we have a really bad tar spot year, well, some of our summer annuals don't get tar spot. So can we use those instead? And so just trying to use it in a way that's beneficial to the farmers, breaking disease cycles, or maybe corn rootworm damage, things like that. And so I think diversity is a good piece in that. And then we have our perennials. I think adding more perennials on the landscape can only be beneficial, keeping soil erosion down, soil aggregates, and things like that. So yeah, really just thinking about how we can do it in a systems way to benefit our farmers.
It's time for our famous three. Explore the future of agriculture with KWS, a global leader in innovation and sustainable farming practices. Uncover the exceptional qualities of our hybrid rye, cultivating a legacy for a greener tomorrow. Visit kws.com/US for more information and for dealer locations. KWS, seeding the future since 1856.
All right. Well, if you're listening to this episode, you're enjoying our conversation, I invite you to subscribe to our podcast in whichever platform you're listening. Drop us a comment if you wish, and also make sure to share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from this great conversation with Dr. Gress. All right. So, Shelby, we're getting towards the end of our episode here with our three last questions that we ask every guest. So the first one is, do you have any favorite resource that you would like to share with us that is specifically related to the technical side that you work with, right? So it could be crops, soil, forage, anything on that technical side.
I absolutely love, there's field guides that get put out. There's a cover crop field guide, corn and soybean field guide. There's a forage field guide. I love those. They're just little pockets of information that it may not be the specific thing you need, but it gives you a start. It's like, okay, that's right. And I know I'm kind of know what I'm looking for better now. I know this is kind of weird, but I love going to, ag forums where farmers are talking on forums. I love to hear what they're doing and saying. It gives me ideas and really kind of gives an idea of, problems they're facing. And the last one I was on, I think it was called Hay Talk or something, just kind of reading some of the threads that are going on.
All right. So our next one is the same question, but outside of the technical side of things. So, you know, do you have any resource, perhaps more on the personal development side that you would like to share with us?
So I can't remember the book's name, but there was this book, but it was about being a leader, and like, it was following a guy and he owned his own business. And he had a hard time delegating tasks. He felt like he needed his hand in everything. And it basically goes through this story about how you're the leader because you have to be the one thinking through other things. So you need to make time to really sit down and think of a plan and think of what your goals are and how are you going to reach those goals, drawing out those step by step. So sorry, I can't remember the name, but I think leadership books are really helpful to becoming a good leader and to also following a leader. Sometimes you are a part of a project and need to be able to follow as well as lead.
All right. So our last question of today is, in your opinion, in your experience, what has been the skill or maybe skill set that you've observed in successful professionals?
I think being an active listener, really being able to have a conversation and not just telling something, but like actively listening to what the person is telling you. I think there's a lot to be said about someone that's not just listening, but really seeing how that person is reacting to you and things like that is super beneficial. I think it shows so much awareness, and you just feel so much better when somebody's actively listening. I think that's an amazing skill set. And some things that I've been a part of team sports my whole life. And so just team players, everybody has a role and not everybody can be the star in every single situation. So people that are willing to work together go a lot farther.
That's really, really great advice. All right. Well, Shelby, that wraps up our episode. Thank you so much for being our guest today. I really appreciated having this conversation with you, learned a lot with you today. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on all things Forage. Really, really great conversation. It was a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.